This is 88.1 WYPR. I'm Erica Kane. Today, we're joined by an accomplished journalist whose voice and reporting have helped audiences make sense of a rapidly changing world. From major global headlines to deeply personal human stories, she has built a reputation for thoughtful storytelling, sharp analysis, and bringing depth to the issues that shape our lives. A long-standing career with the BBC and most recently added to the lineup of BBC's flagship show, NewsHour. She has reported across continents, covered pivotal moments in history, and helped connect listeners and viewers to stories that matter far beyond the headlines. And she will be joining us for a live broadcast here in our Baltimore studios on Wednesday, May 6th. We're honored to have with us Rajini Vaidyanathan. Rajini, thank you so much for joining us today.
This is radio, Erica, so you can't see that I'm blushing after your introduction. It's a pleasure to join you speak to you ahead of our trip.
Yes, well, introduction well-deserved, and we are looking forward to having you back in Baltimore.
Yes, because I've been to Baltimore many times. And as I was saying to you just before we went on air with this, I was looking through my phone to find, you know, the great thing about phones now is you can search by cities. And I put in Baltimore and I found an image of a bench that says Baltimore is the greatest city in America.
Oh, don't you agree?
Well, it depends how much the welcome I get. I am an impartial BBC journalist, and therefore all cities are great in America.
Well, there you go. Well, you know, you were based in DC for 6 years, so do you miss the area?
I do. It's interesting because I've been back and forth to the United States through my BBC career for a long time. I first came over for the BBC for the Bush-Gore election, which of course at the time felt like there'd be no other election like it. And then I was based in DC properly for a bit for the end of George W. Bush and of course the election of Barack Obama. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, as everyone did, this was a moment of history, a moment that really did see a sea change in American politics. But then, of course, I covered the 2016 race and the election of Donald Trump. And it felt like that was a new era in American politics. And so it keeps getting bigger and bigger, doesn't it? And busier and busier as well, Erica.
You mentioned all the campaigns you've covered here in the U.S. and how each time around it's like, wow, we've never seen anything like this before. Are you seeing anything this time around that's shocking?
You mean the fact that President Trump has a second term?
That and everything transpiring thereafter.
Yeah, you know what? I spent a lot of time in 2016 getting out of the DC Beltway, as it's called, and getting out of big cities. So, for example, meeting people not just in Baltimore, but going to other parts of Maryland, maybe Frederick, or even further west, and likewise traveling across some 30 states in the US. So I really got a sense, and I'm not just saying this because I'm speaking to you, but I was one of the few people in my office at the time, early through the campaign, who thought that President Trump was going to do it, or Donald Trump at the time, as he was a candidate, of course. And so I think it's important not to underestimate the fact that there are a lot of people who do really agree with what he stands for. And I think it is tricky at the moment, though, isn't it? Because it's really hard to decipher the pace at which things are happening. And it kind of reminds me, Erica, of when I was based in the United States. And every morning I would wake up and look at what he'd tweeted at the time. Of course, now it's Truth Social posts. And you know, one of the things that I remember, and you probably remember it too, Erica, is the day he tweeted that word covfefe. None of us knew what it meant.
Right.
And I remember a day of broadcasting about that. So it was funny because a lot of the time, you know, people in DC were transfixed with what was going on through social or on Twitter at the time. And I think in some ways, I suppose, to answer your question, things haven't changed since then. It's still very much that things are happening and the pace of politics in DC is just getting faster and faster. And that's why I think when I was based in America for a long time, it was really important for me to get out of, you know, the Beltway, get out of Washington, D.C., and go and speak to people. And that's why I've been to Baltimore on quite a few occasions. And that's why I am excited to return and see how things have changed.
And during your time here in Baltimore, it was an intense time. There were things happening here, right here in Baltimore, that were making international headlines at the time. Do you feel you had a chance to jump into Baltimore politics and really see what was going on?
Yeah, I mean, I covered the protests, the riots that they were eventually. It was quite violent, I remember, after the death of Freddie Gray, who, as we all know, died in police custody. And it was, I think, to my memory, what, maybe 6 to 8 months after the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, which I also had been to. Those two moments for me made me want to understand the civil rights movement and race relations in America. I ended up making a 4-part series for the World Service back then. It was called America in Black and White, to understand some of the underlying reasons why there is structural racism, you know, redlining in properties back in, you know, the 60s and the 50s, racial profiling, all these things that in some ways still do exist. And I think the case of Freddie Gray, and I covered the trial as well, was an example of some of the economic disparities between different racial groups, and also the sort of, with redlining, for example, how America's map of segregation was kind of won by design, mm-hmm. where certain families were not allowed to get mortgages in certain areas, and how that impacted the wider area. It impacted the schools people could go to and all of that. So for me, it was a real journey into what is fundamentally one of the most important things to understand in America.
And besides the stories you've covered here in America, in the U.S., and in the U.K., you've reported across continents and cultures. So when it comes to international reporting, how has that changed the scope and the way you interpret local stories and community issues?
I think in the end, you know, I have been based in Washington. I've covered stories well beyond the U.S. covered earthquakes in Mexico. I was also based in South Asia on two separate occasions. So I've covered natural disasters. I've covered floods in Pakistan, landslides in India. I've covered political unrest in Sri Lanka, uprisings. I mean, most recently, I was in Hungary, where I witnessed thousands of people line the banks of the River Danube in Budapest as Viktor Orban was unseated from power after 16 years. So I've seen real moments of change. But in the end, what I think has been a common thread in all of the reporting that I've done, including in the United States, is just getting the human story. And I think what I bring to the program in terms of that is understanding that the perspectives around the world don't just come from Washington. They come from other countries and other nations. And the power and the rise of Asia is something that we should not ignore. Mm-hmm. And so seeing the world and interacting with audiences from Asia to obviously the UK, I used to cover British politics as well, and of course America, I think gives me a real sense that there is no one centre and there's so many different perspectives. Every story has a value as long as you can find a way to humanly connect it to the listener, wherever they are.
Regine, you say every story has its value. What stories out there right now do you feel are just not being seen?
I think one of the stories that needs to be watched closely, but with everything going on in conflicts in other various parts of the world, can be overlooked. It's just the rise of India. Now, I would say that because I was based in India as a correspondent for 6 years in total on two separate postings. But India is the most populous country in the world. It has huge clout on the diplomatic stage as well. We've seen how it's a non-aligned country, in terms of its relationships with Russia, as well as, of course, the United States. Mm-hmm. It is also a fascinating country culturally. The art, the music, the food, there's so much that's coming out of it. And I think sometimes it's so easy to look at China as the country in Asia that we have to cover. And of course, that's important because of what China represents economically as well as socially and socioeconomically. But I think India is one of those stories that in, 20, 30 years time, we'll all wish we understood more.
And all the stories that you've covered, the places you've been, you've had a front row seat to major world events. Looking at everything that's happening in the world today, what issue do you think historians would look back on and say, we underestimated in this moment currently?
That's a difficult one. But I think probably some of the uprisings or people taking to the streets to overthrow a government, or maybe not even overthrow, but elections that have kind of seen a sea change, have been some of those moments. I mean, for example, let's just look at what I reported on a couple of weeks ago. I was in Budapest, as I mentioned, to cover the Hungarian parliamentary elections. We saw J.D. Vance, didn't we, fly over while he had a lot going on his way to Pakistan, mm-hmm. to support Viktor Orban, the far-right populist leader who'd, as I said, been in power for 16 years. But I think at the start of the year, No one was perhaps watching it that closely. No one maybe even thought, well, could this be a massive change? And what does this mean, not just for the European Union and people in Europe, but what does it mean for the world? You know, Viktor Orban had close ties with the Kremlin and, of course, was close to the White House as well, but was a thorn in the EU side. So I think sometimes it's just looking at these political movements and moments and seeing, I mean, that's the beauty of, I've covered so many elections, and that's what's the beauty of covering, you know, a democratic exercise like an election, is just seeing people put their votes into a ballot box and what that change can be. And I think the other one for me, because I've covered it in different guises, is just the role of women and survivors in particularly sexual abuse cases, having the confidence to speak up. Back in the day, covered quite a lot of the early stages of the then Prince Andrew's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. I was in West Palm Beach on a number of occasions and was in regular contact with the late Virginia Giuffre's lawyers and covered a lot of that early in my time when I was in the United States. And back then, I don't think any of us thought we'd get to where we were today with the Epstein files. And, you know, likewise, I covered the trial of Larry Nassar, the US gymnastics coach who abused countless young women. I covered the call for a Me Too movement in the Indian film industry, Bollywood. And it's all about just one brave woman, two brave women coming out, speaking, and then suddenly the floodgates open and other people feel that kind of solidarity and the confidence to speak. And I think that's one of those things that nobody could have really expected. And like I say, if you look at the trajectory from when I was standing outside the court in West Palm Beach, as Virginia Giuffre or Roberts, as the court documents had first set out her allegations against the then Prince Andrew, of course, allegations that he's consistently denied, to think to where we are today with so many survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse coming out, speaking out, and actually finally being listened to by people in the higher echelons of society.
And how are UK audiences responding to these current events?
In general, people are, what we're seeing at the BBC is a real, particularly since the war, a real interest in the story. So we're seeing massive rise in audiences who are listening, who are watching, who are reading online. And so in some ways, although you might think people are disengaged, don't want to have the sort of doom and gloom of what's happening in the world, what is interesting is just how audiences are engaging with what's going on and coming to trusted sources like the BBC to try and cut through some of the fog that's out there and get clarity, analysis, and of course, facts.
And that, Regini, I'm sure is refreshing to hear for listeners who are losing trust in the media or feeling like it's harder to find sources of unbiased information.
My job is to be a journalist. My job isn't to be an activist. It's not to be a campaigner. It's to be a friend to our listeners, a regular voice in their ear who's guiding them through some of the things that are happening around the world. Some of them are complicated to me. They're complicated to our listeners. We do our best to try and cut through some of the noise and the fog to explain, for example, what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz at the moment, or maybe explain something in another part of the world that perhaps, you know, many listeners may not be accustomed to. So all of that is based on the fact that, you know, the BBC's core principles are that we are accurate and we are impartial and we are fair. You know, what listeners take away and do with that is sort of the next step, but nothing that we can kind of influence. That's not our job. We're just here to ensure that we are telling the news as it is. And that might sound like something that is obvious, but in the world and the media landscape that we live in, that's not always something we can take for granted, is it?
Absolutely not. And you mentioned people coming to the BBC. First of all, congratulations on officially coming on board to NewsHour last December and expanding your presence there at the BBC. What do you enjoy bringing to listeners on NewsHour?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is, I was a listener of NewsHour, and then I graduated to being a correspondent, would appear on NewsHour from various corners of the world. And I always used to be really nervous about being a correspondent appearing on NewsHour because the rigor, the high standards, the stories, You know, it's just the BBC at its best. So I sort of had to pinch myself when I got this role, because it really is a programme that in an hour you can get a sense of what's happening in every corner of the world. It's not focused on any particular country. And I think it really leans on the brilliance of the BBC and its reach. We have reporters in all corners of the world, not just through our English language services, but of course our language services in many, many different parts of the world. But also, I think the thing about NewsHour is we really pride ourselves on the rigour of how we conduct interviews as well. Accountability interviews, challenging people in power, and also having a bit of light and shade. So I think whenever you listen to the programme, you get a sense of what you need to know, what's the big story in the world. And it might not always be a UK or a US focused story. I mean, I remember when I first joined the team, this was the first programme that really looked at what was going on in Sudan and the civil war, a really important story. And so sometimes because of the openness to an agenda, we might get to things before other outlets do.
Well, Regini, we thank you for being a friend when we need you through those speakers and being a friend to Baltimore. We look forward to having you in the area when you come to visit. Regini Vaidyanathan, she's going to be here live at WYPR Studios May 6th. She's from BBC's News Hour, and we are looking forward to having you here. Thank you so much for chatting with
me
today. I
can't wait, Erica. I need all the good restaurant recommendations, please, because I'm sure there's some good places I need to come and visit.
Listen, I've got recommendations, and we can hit a couple together, and it'll be a good time, okay?
I look forward to that. Thank you, Erica.
Have a great day, and safe travels.
Thanks. Bye-bye.